Today's episode is brought to you by Show Up Society. If you are ready to overcome perfectionism and overthinking so you can grow your creative business, join the Show Up Society today. This supportive community helps you build confidence in your craft, in yourself, and in promoting your work. You'll get a perfect mix of practical tips and mindset hacks to grow your business without feeling salesy and without burnout. You'll have fun and feel supported while taking your creative business to new heights. Go to showupsociety.com/join today. Thank you so much, Show Up Society. And now, here's the show. Welcome to episode 263 of the Craft Industry Alliance podcast. I'm Abby Glassenberg. Craft Industry Alliance is a community for craft professionals where you can strengthen your creative business, stay up to date on industry news, and build connections within our supportive trade association. Check it out at craftindustryalliance.org. Today on the show, we're talking about embroidery and illustration with my guest, Sarah Barnes. Sarah is an embroidery illustrator and writer living in Seattle, Washington. She runs Bear and Bean, an embroidery studio stitching pet portraits and other beloved creatures. Her work has been recognized in American Illustration, Embroidery Magazine, and Uppercase. Sarah chronicles the creativity of others through her blog, Brown Paper Bag, and weekly newsletter, Orts. Her newest book is Threads of Treasure, How to Make, Mend, and Find Meaning Through Thread. When she's not stitching or writing, she enjoys planning things that bring people together, including Camp Craftaway, a day camp for crafty adults with hands-on workshops. Sarah Barnes, welcome.
Hi, hello. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm so glad to have you on the show. And you are an awesome newsletter writer, and I love newsletters. So we're going to get into that because I want to definitely talk with you about your awesome newsletter. But let's first start with the new book. So it's called Threads of Treasure, which I mentioned. And can you just tell us about it? What's inside of it? What can we expect if we buy one?
Yeah. So Threads of Treasure is kind of examining the idea of treasure in three sort of specific ways by means of embroidery and fiber art. So if we think about treasure in these three ways, one of the ways I do it is I break down treasure as treasuring an object. So this more traditional idea of what we think of as treasure, we have this thing that we really love. And by doing that, I talk to different artists who utilize found objects in their work. And then the second section is treasuring the things that we already have. So mending, adorning clothing, really this idea of repair and treasuring the environment by way of doing that. And again, I talk to artists who are mending clothing or adorning clothing in their work, and that's the main part of their practice. And the third section is treasuring sort of everyday moments. So that would be, you know, practice, artistic practice as a way of treasuring that the time that we have here on earth. So I really specifically talk to artists who have practices where they're doing the same sort of project on a long-term basis. So maybe that's 100 days, a year or longer. And we talk about kind of what you learn. And within these three sections, I talk to artists. That's the bulk of the book, is talking to these artists and profiling them in their work. But in each section, there's a takeaway. So a sort of you can do this part of the chapter, where I talk about sort of the concepts that were discussed in those artist profiles and give you ways, concrete ways that you can exercise them for yourself. So it's DIY-esque. It's DIY-esque to sort of get you creating, but it's not a super prescriptive sort of way of creating. It's really getting you to take these artist profiles, to kind of like internalize it and use it as a way to, you know, make your own work and to express yourself through art, particularly fiber art and embroidery.
Wonderful. Okay, great. So that's a great plug for that book. It sounds beautiful and very inspiring. My guess is there's some beautiful photography inside as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah. So the artists, I mean, there's 13 different artists I talked to, and you know, they share their wonderful images. So some that I can think of off the bat are Hillary Waters Fail, so who takes leaves and stitches on top of them. And there are these extremely intricate designs that you wouldn't imagine could be on a leaf, a real living leaf. And there's no glue involved, so it's all stitching. Jessica Grady, who uses different found objects. So she's in the treasuring objects section. But she takes things that we would normally discard, like, you know, washers or bottle caps or something like that you would normally throw away, but turns them into works of art and kind of redefines them and makes them into treasure. And then in another section, the mending section, Tessa Perlow, who makes these beautiful, she uses all secondhand garments and stitches on them and just turns them into mobile works of art, you know, with giant florals that go up and down and all these other sorts of great imagery. And then in the last section, Hannah Claire Somerville, who I became familiar with many years ago. She started the project 1 Year of Stitches, which is the basic idea is you just take one, you make at least one stitch on the same piece of fabric every day for a year and you document it. I did it in 2017 and it was pretty life-changing for me. It was really formative. So getting to talk to her was really great. So yeah, but they all share their beautiful imagery and really just inspiring.
Absolutely. Okay, wonderful. So I want to talk, we're going to lead up to how this book sort of came about, but let's now go all the way back. So where did you grow up and did you always know that you wanted to be an artist? Were you an artistic kid?
Yeah, so I grew up in Kansas City, Missouri, and yeah, I've always really loved art. I have, you know, very like early memories of just sitting at on my couch drawing what was ever on my parents' coffee table. And I was really lucky that my parents really encouraged my art making from a really young age. So I did a lot of day camps. I did a lot of like outside art classes beyond just what you learned in school. And I got to try a lot of things. I was also really lucky to be able to go to the School of the Art Institute of Chicago during college, or not during college, it's called pre-college. So you would go between junior and senior year. So yeah, I went to a program like that. And they were always very supportive.
Sure.
So I was really lucky that I was able to really hone my skills that way and to just play around with a lot of things.
And I know you also really enjoy writing, and this new book is very writing focused, as was your first book, which we'll talk about. But have you always been a writer or did that come later?
I've always enjoyed writing. The writing came from, I graduated undergrad in 2008, which was a horrible time to graduate college with a degree in illustration. So I had to, you know, just take a really boring office job to make money. And so while I was there, it wasn't a creative job at all. I started a blog and I started writing a lot more. And in doing that, that's how I really learned to write, you know, about other people's work that wasn't mine. And that's how I really gained my skills. And I eventually went to grad school and I knew, because I went to grad school for illustration, but I knew that I had this like blog that I loved writing in. So any sort of electives I could take, I took writing electives.
Okay. So when you were growing up, your parents were very supportive of your art, which was awesome. Did you take art classes in high school? Was there any particular teachers or experiences that were really formative?
Yeah. So I took a lot of art classes my senior year. We were on a block schedule, I remember. So we took 8 classes for the whole year, so 4 classes a semester. And I took 6 art classes out of 8. So I was really into it. And as far as teachers that were really formative in high school, I think I actually learned the most actually at that pre-college program that I went to in Chicago, because that's where we really had to like learn to critique and things like that. So I remember there was one teacher, Miss Meyer, who she did a fiber arts class that was in high school. So beyond this like pre-college program, I did take a fiber arts class with her. And that's how I learned how to do batik and things like that. And she really let me sort of explore. So I am grateful for that. But all through high school, I really thought I was going to be a painter. That's why I went to MICA, the Maryland Institute College of Art, for undergrad, because I knew their painting program was great. I really wanted to be a painter. I got to my first semester and I was just like, the painting program is not for me. This is not my jam. I don't think that this is going to work. So I had to think to pick something else, and I picked illustration.
And I know you've said in some posts that you've written and things that you felt like you weren't the world's best drawer, lack of a better word, renderer, you know. And I think that's something a lot of us can relate to. You know, it's like you're in there, and I'm sure there are people who are your peers, and you look over at their paper and you're like, oh my gosh, like you are just really good at this. And I mean, I can relate to that as well. It's like, I can draw, but I'm not the world's best drawer. So how did you get through an illustration degree feeling that way?
Yeah. So I was told I wasn't a very good drawer in a drawing class, which was not part of the illustration program. Luckily, that was, I think, also part of what spurred me to go to that direction. I was told I wasn't a very good drawer. I don't have the patience, I think, to do this fine rendering that I think probably a lot of people think of as like a really good drawer. I'm not great with draftsmanship and things like that. So what I did was I kind of muddled my way through that class. I learned as much as I could. And then when it came time to pursue my illustration major, I focused on a style that didn't require the sort of anatomical correctness that was required of like a charcoal drawing, you know, what we might think of as a charcoal drawing, or like what we think of, like, we have certain expectations, is what I'm trying to say. When we look at a charcoal drawing of like a human figure, we kind of expect for it to be right. But if it's in a different medium, it's like an ink and it's kind of a more cartoonish style, we don't have the same sort of expectations on those figures. And so I started by doing pen and ink drawings and kind of experimenting from there. And I've always really loved collage. Beyond painting, that was a big part of my high school portfolio, was collage. So I went back to that and I just started doing a lot more cut paper collage, looking at the work of Eric Carle, who would paint his papers and cut them out. And I kind of went from this pen and ink style that wasn't exactly what I loved doing to collage. And I had a critic in one of my classes who said really liked my collages, and she encouraged me to just kind of take it farther, because, you know, I was at this uncomfortable moment sort of in my style and figuring out what I wanted to do, where it was, you know, some drawing with some paper, and it was kind of like teetering on the edge of all collage and all drawing. But this person really encouraged me to really just do everything in cut paper. If I was doing a portrait of someone, you know, do their eyelashes in cut paper. And so that kind of gave me the inspiration and the permission to really start working in cut paper and, you know, using other materials in my work in a collage-like manner, which again sort of helps with this fact I wasn't a great drawer, because collage is even further away from like what we would expect with fine rendering. I could kind of do whatever I want, flatten the subject in any way I wanted and make it really graphic. So that just really was a big turning point for me and ultimately shapes the way I think about how to draw and how I make my own work now.
So you graduated from college. It's 2008. There are no jobs. So you get this office job and that's how you start a blog. Were you reading... 2008 was pretty early in the blog world for mm-hmm. makers. Were you reading blogs that you were inspired by? I feel like, you know, there were some really lovely early art blogs out there. And were you kind of participating in that community prior to starting your own?
No, not that I remember. I really remember getting into blogging because I was a poor, just graduated college person. And I needed to like figure out how to stretch my wardrobe and shop my own closet. So I actually started with these What I Wore Today blogs, which were super popular back then. And I was just like, oh, I love reading these. I love how they put their personality out there. And I'm like, well, I like writing. I've kept like, you know, I had a blogger at one point in college. You know, my friends and I would have like these blogs we would update to tell each other what we were doing during our summer vacations and stuff like that. So I was familiar with like blogging and like writing. But I, you know, when I was like looking at these What I Wore Today style blogs and I wanted to do something similar with blogging, I was like, well, I'm not like a fashion person, but I do like art. I like looking at art. I, you know, social media was not what it is today, but I was still like on Twitter and, you know, seeing other artists promote their work that way and, you know, finding their work by just sort of clicking around online. And so I was like, okay, well, I want to do a blog. I'm not a fashion person, but I do know how to talk about art. And I like looking at work. I like all of this stuff. So I'll just make a blog about it. And at that point, I had also, you know, I was out of college and I was kind of figuring out what I was going to do next. I was doing some illustration freelance, but I really was like thinking I would maybe go into web design or something like that because I've always liked doing, you know, working on websites and stuff too. So I took a class on HTML and CSS at one of the local colleges in Baltimore. And I gained some skills that allowed me to manipulate like a WordPress blog to make it look how I want. And then Brown Paper Bag was born after that.
I want to take a minute now to talk about our sponsor, the Show Up Society. Imagine waking up and getting right to work on a project in your creative business. You have energy and inspiration, and you know exactly what to work on. You have confidence that you're creating something people want to see or buy. You know that you can finish this project and finish it on time. You know how to overcome that urge to procrastinate. You know exactly how to handle that negative self-talk, self-doubt, and indecision. Once you finish the project, you put it right up for sale on your website and promote it online without feeling salesy or gross. Or maybe you submit your work to magazines, crafting websites, contests, juried art shows, or trade shows. You get tons of great feedback and opportunities. You know exactly what to say about your work, and you feel comfortable sharing it online. Then you check in on your creative business owning friends to share your wins and struggles and remind yourself that you're not alone. After all of that, you still have time and energy for me time or exercise. This life is possible for you. You don't have to go at this alone and you don't have to suffer. You can grow your creative business in a fun, supportive community, building your confidence all along the way. This is where the Show Up Society comes in. Inside the Show Up Society community, creative coach Tammy Bennett gives you a perfect mix of practical tips and mindset hacks to help you build your creative business without burnout, but with a lot of fun. Each month, you'll learn tips and tools to build your business, and you'll actually apply them. This is not another course where you sign up but don't use the materials. In the Show Up Society, you'll accomplish tasks in co-working calls, workshop calls, and fun challenges. Anytime you get stuck, you can come to a coaching call or ask for help in the group. Coach Tammy and the other community members will be there to share support, give advice, and get you back on track. You'll also have a private online community to safely share your wins, struggles, and ask for feedback. The energy of the community will lift you when the inevitable struggles of being a perfectionist creative come up. go to showupsociety.com/join today to find your people and grow your business with joy. You'll be amazed at what can happen for you when you keep showing up. Thank you so much to Tammy Bennett and the Show Up Society. And now, back to the show.
So,
And there was a blog first that was called Marshmallow Kisses.
Oh, yeah, that was like a personal thing.
A personal one. Okay.
That was kind of like a personal thing. I read about my own practice. I was just like, I want to write about practice that's not mine and make it just about that. So I kind of abandoned that eventually and just went to Brown Paper Bag.
Okay. And then how did you choose the name Brown Paper Bag? Because I think it's a great name. It's a name that can be anything, which is really a good thing when you're starting a project like that, that could morph into anything. So kind of smart. And like, you still have it. So this is many, many years later. And I'm sure it's evolved over time. But how did you choose that name?
Yeah. So you actually hit the nail on the head. Like, it was, I loved how versatile brown craft paper is. At that point, I was still doing collage, all collage. And that was like a staple of my collage paper, like my collage paper collection. So it was sort of based on that. And when I first started it, it was kind of a works on paper blog. So it was really featuring like a lot of illustration and people who were working on paper. So
I see. It was more paper focused, right?
Right. Yeah. It was a lot more like, paper focused illustration, stuff like that. And it's only within like, as I sort of grew and started doing embroidery, then it became more textile art. But really it can be anything, as you pointed out.
Right. So how did you get introduced to reintroduced to embroidery? Because it sounds like you were introduced to it a bit like in high school and growing up. But how did you come back to embroidery and sort of dive into that versus just sticking with collage? Because you could have just stuck with collage.
Yeah. So it was sort of a long time. It was sort of like crept towards embroidery. So, I mean, years before I even started embroidering seriously, I was given a set of, or like a collection of yarn or like thin yarn from somebody I knew who was getting rid of it. And she knew I did collage and she's like, well, maybe you'll want to use this one day. And it really sat in my art supplies collection for probably at least 5 years. And it was only when I really started going a little beyond cut paper that I was like, oh, well, I could stitch on paper. I could take this, like this thread or yarn. It was very thin. I don't know what you, now I cannot even remember like what you would maybe call it, probably like a very thin yarn. And I just started stitching, I'd use it to enhance certain elements of my work. If I wanted to really call attention to one part, and that was really fun. But if you've ever stitched on paper, it's pretty challenging because you have to be very precise with your holes or else you're going to end up with like a big mess. And that was just, I really enjoyed stitching. I really enjoyed the stitching part. And so then I got some embroidery thread, like some DMC floss, started stitching on fabric for fun. And then eventually I moved from Baltimore to Minneapolis and really had to downsize. And, moving halfway across the country, I couldn't take my big paper collection with me. I wasn't really doing a lot of collage at that point. And so I was just like, I'm just going to focus on embroidery. And I got rid of the paper that I had and just took my thread with me. And then, so probably since, 2017, 2018 is really when I've only been doing embroidery or, fiber art.
Okay. And so what were your embroidery pieces looking like at that time? Were they realistic? Were they more like, what we might think of as like decorative motifs, or what kind of embroidery were you doing?
Yeah. So I would say it was very early stuff was very, it was very just, simple shapes, really just, a bunch of like rectangles and these abstract patterns, rectangles, triangles, things like that. Some florals, some floral motifs in sort of a decorative pattern, but nothing very cohesive, I would say. It was really just kind of testing out different types of stitches, different imagery and thread, but nothing super cohesive. It was only until I did that 1 year of stitches project where I really got to the chance to sort of explore and see what I liked. And from there, I started, you know, when left to my own devices, I draw cats and dogs and stuff like that. And I incorporated a lot of that into my 1 year of stitches project. You know, it was a lot of like, I had some like cats and stuff like that, or I think. And so then I really started going towards more animals and plants and objects, which I always have really loved drawing and painting and stuff. So that's where that came from.
Okay. And I'd love to talk a little bit more about the blog. So blogging has definitely changed. I mean, you started blogging before Instagram, for example, but you kept going. I think a lot of people sort of abandoned it at, you know, the 2014-13 phase when they started to see it was just easier to take a photo on your phone and write a caption and document things and share things that way. But you kept going. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how it's changed, the process of blogging for you, the way you think about blogging has changed over all of these years, and also how it's served you, how the blog has served you over all of these years.
Yeah. So I think when I first started, it was really about just these fun, sort of like, I felt a lot more casual, I would say. I would share someone's work, write a little bit about it, and just kind of put it online. And I was posting a lot more frequency. I also had a lot more time back then. So I would post like 3 times a day when I first started.
Wow.
But these weren't very involved blog posts. They were maybe like 150 words or something like that. And sort of as blogging became more something that I was being recognized for, and I was eventually led to getting jobs that way, I really was like, okay, I learned a lot more about SEO and what makes a searchable blog post and what can I do to promote, you know, because you can write something and if you don't have a way of kind of promoting it, it just kind of goes out into the ether. So it's like, okay, how can I use SEO, use social media to bring traffic to my blog? And so it kind of took some of the sort of casual fun from it, from like the, you know, early 2010s. And then as, you know, the 2010s wore on, I really got, okay, I need to be more strategic about what I'm putting out there. So I would, I would do keyword research basically. And so like one of my biggest posts, and still to this day, it brings in traffic and affiliate, is, you know, just embroidery patterns, because that's a big term people are searching for. So I did that pretty early on. And, that really helped. So I really had to get more strategic about it. So it just wasn't as like casual and fun, which I don't really mind. I like the sort of strategic part of it. So that's how it's changed, or how I've seen it change a lot. But how it served me was I made a lot of connections. So a lot of the people I talked to in the book, I had connected with online years before because I've written about them on my blog. So I would say that's probably the biggest thing for me, is it gave me some like internet cred. So when I was reaching out for the book, people were familiar with me because I had featured them on my blog, and we had made that connection beforehand. So I think just having it for so long and people being familiar with it, even though I'm very bad about updating it, I try to do it once a week now, which is a far cry from 3 times a day and like, you know, 15 years ago or whatever. But it really just helped build these really authentic connections, I think is the main thing.
And I wondered how you met Sarah K. Benning, because Sarah is an embroidery artist and she's been on the show as well. And the two of you connected at some point because you wrote the book about Sarah that that was published by Chronicle a couple of years ago.
Yeah. So through my blog, I wrote about her work. I probably in like the mid 2010s when I started really looking embroidery, started noticing a lot more embroidery. And Sarah was really, I think, on the forefront of, you know, that style of stitching and sharing her work and sharing her life. And so I wrote about her and I think we connected in that way. And, you know, had like kind of kept in touch. She's actually from Baltimore and I was living there at the time. So, you know, had this familiarity as well. So we had that sort of connection. And so when I was, you know, pitching things to Chronicle to write, you know, Sarah came up and, you know, I already had this sort of like connection with Sarah. We'd already like, you know, talked to each other online. And so it was kind of like a natural fit.
And I wanted to go back for 1 second to featuring other artists on your blog. I think some people would have the question of how do you do that? In other words, do you write an email to them and say, hello, this is who I am. I would like to feature you on my blog. Can we schedule a phone call or can I send you some Q&A via email for you to answer? Or do you just look at everything and write from what you see? What about requesting photo permissions and all of that? So just tell us how that works. Like if somebody has a blog or wants to start a blog and wants to do something similar, what is the procedure?
Yeah. So I think things have also changed a bit since I started. I would never really ask for permissions at the beginning of when I was blogging. I would just kind of see what I liked and what I wrote about and would write it. And I noticed that as kind of like social media really took off and, you know, companies will steal images and all this stuff, artists started getting a lot more diligent about sort of what their permissions are and like featuring their work. And so it kind of depends. I like to think about things in advance, but in practice, it doesn't always work out for me because I just, you know, just got so many things on my plate, unfortunately. So a lot of times just would write about the artist without contacting them and then feature them later. And if there was some sort of issue, if they said like, please take down, I don't want my work featured, please take it down, I would absolutely do that. But nothing ever, you know, doing that has never, bit me in the butt or anything. I've never been like sued or anything like that or gotten some sort of cease and desist letter. I think partially because I'm just like a blogger. I'm not like a big company trying to like, you know, feature their, like steal their images and pass them off to try and sell something. I'm generally featuring their work and writing something positive about it. So it's never been an issue for me. Nowadays, I do try to get permissions, or if I don't have time to get permissions, I'll embed something for like an Instagram post or something and write it that way, just because that just seems to be a bit safer because they can always take down that post and it would be removed from my blog. Now I also just don't write in my blog a ton. So the times that I do, it's for really special things. So I have been posting the last couple of weeks about, you know, interviews with artists who are in my book. And so that I have the permission for. But I definitely think things have changed and I would be a lot more apprehensive now just featuring all these other, you know, just mm-hmm. not asking for permissions and asking for forgiveness.
Yeah, I do think things have changed. It's interesting. Okay, so how did you connect with Chronicle? Because it sounds like you were pitching ideas to Chronicle and that's how Sarah's name came up. Did you meet an editor at Chronicle somewhere or how did you connect with them? Because it can be a little challenging. I mean, they're a really big publishing house and well-known and they have very beautiful books and products. So how did you connect?
Yeah. So again, online through my blog and Instagram. So as I was blogging, I was starting up Brown Paper Bags Instagram and grew it pretty good size. I've been kind of burned out on it the last couple of years because I used to post a ton and it was just a lot of work. But I had a big following. So an editor at Chronicle Books, who's also an author, Bridget Watson Payne, messaged me about featuring her book on my Instagram and asking me to post an image of her book. So I did that. And, you know, she said, thank you. And she's just like, have you ever thought about writing a book? I'd love to, you know, connect with you about that. And so I was like, sure. And that's when we started pitching. So I made that connection through my Instagram and, you know, featuring her work. And it just sort of came organically that way.
Okay, I see. And so had you always wanted to write a book? Was that like super exciting since it kind of combines your two interests?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, extremely exciting. I love long form writing. And so I also really like diving into the story of, you know, one person or doing a profile of an artist. So that book about Sarah was a great way to do that. I got to spend, you know, 4 days with her and her husband. They were living in New Hampshire at the time. And so really got to just sort of embed myself in her world for a bit, which was really fun. That book was really fun to write for that reason. And it helped me, you know, I think ultimately helped me get, you know, the book that I, you know, Threads of Treasure, helped get that sort of in motion years later.
I wondered why when you pitch this to Sarah, I mean, you kind of came up with the idea, I'm assuming, and then kind of went to her. Was she like, oh no, I can write my book myself? Or, you know what I'm saying? Cause like you wrote her story on her behalf.
Yeah. So I think for her, I don't think she writes, but I don't think that she's like the long form writer that, you know, is, you know, required of writing, you know, 20,000 plus words on your work, or that was like the best use of her time. So for her she was really involved. She did all the image selection and she was really involved in that way, in the image selection. So I think that was, you know, the better use of her time. And then, you know, going through and just having someone that she already knew and, you know, trusted ostensibly to write her story was the right move for her. I don't want to put words in her mouth, but that was sort of the feeling that I got when we were writing it.
It's interesting because I've pitched books that didn't have patterns in them, craft books without patterns. And this is a craft book that didn't have patterns. And when you look at the reviews, there's people who are like, there are no patterns. What kind of book is this? Yeah. And it's frustrating because when you pitch books, so often editors at craft publishing houses will tell you, okay, well, that's all very well and good, but you need 20 patterns in order for this to be a book. And you know, it's like, can we just get away from the 20 pattern situation? Because patterns are easy to buy now, especially an embroidery pattern. And Sarah sells them. Many people sell them and you can buy them as a PDF and print them out at home and have them instantly, et cetera. We don't need a book with 20 patterns. But yet, still, the consumer seems to want that. And I don't know how you think about that frustration in reading those reviews and thinking about that book.
So I actually don't read the reviews. I am very much like, I don't need to see that. I'm good. But I think like I understand that sort of like, you know, attitude. But Sarah had an extremely successful pattern program. So it wouldn't really behoove her to you know, put these patterns in and then, you know, you get like a advance or whatever for your book and you might make royalties back, or you can publish a pattern and continue collecting on it years and years later. So from a financial standpoint, I totally get why you wouldn't want to do that. I think for a consumer, you can have that sort of instant gratification of picking one and then just being able to download it. So, Yeah. I'm also not a pattern consumer. I think that's probably another big thing. I do all of my own drawings and make my own embroidery patterns and don't ever really download anybody else's. So I think I'm also just like not the target consumer for that. So I would rather read a book that talks about someone's life and their artistic journey, because for me, that's more useful. I'm going to learn something from them that I can maybe take and internalize myself and then use it in my own work rather than having to, replicate something. But I also come at it from a very different standpoint of like, I have this really long education in formal training in art, and I've done this for a long time and been able to spend the time and the energy kind of considering my own work and my own practice. And so I just have a very different viewpoint
right.
from someone who is approaching it from, this is a hobby I'm interested in.
The new book is published by Schiffer. So I wondered whether Chronicle had first right of refusal, or how did that work?
I had pitched something to Chronicle after the book with Sarah, but this was so this would have been like 2018, 2019. And they were just like, we'll pass. And so that was, years. And I was just like, okay, I'm like not going to pitch anything for a while. If I have an idea, I can reach out to my networks. At that point, about the time that the book came out and I was working on pitches, I actually moved again to Seattle. So I wasn't really in the headspace of trying to come up with anything like a book or anything like that. And about the time I moved was when my husband and I were downsizing again. It's very expensive to live in Seattle. So we had to move from a small apartment to an even smaller apartment. So we were getting rid of clothes and stuff like that. And he had this shirt that he was thinking of giving to Goodwill. And he knew I had wanted to sort of embroider on collars. And he gave that to me. I embroidered some cats on a collar. And I posted it online and it totally like blew up in a great way. And that really propelled me from writing and really trying to do another book to really exploring this sort of embroidery that I do today. So when Threads of Treasure came about, that was years later. So that was probably 2022 when, I first started having those conversations. So that was years between that. And I had just done a lot of embroidery between that time and really been exploring that.
Okay. And yeah, these collared, I mean, I sent it to my daughter because I just know that, and she's 20, her reaction was, OMG. So like, it's just a very shareable image because mm-hmm. you can imagine like the collar of like a button down shirt. And then the sort of tip of the collar where the little triangle is mm-hmm. on each side has a pet on it. And I mean, it's like beyond adorable. So, and they're really, really cute. I mean, talk about rendering. They're like very realistic and very adorable renderings of animals in thread. And so you started kind of a new brand for this, and started doing these pet portraits. And how does that work as far as custom commissions, right? Because everybody's dog and cat looks slightly different, et cetera. And so, I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of work that goes into managing people's expectations and all of that when it comes to custom pet portraits. And so what have you learned in that process?
Yeah. So this is where like my education as an illustrator came in really handy because I treat them like I would an illustration job. So with illustration, you're typically, you're working for a client, you would do sketches for that client and get their approval and then move on to like the final image. And so once they approve that final sketch, then, that's your key to go. So I do something similar with commissions where I'll do a sketch, a mock-up of what the embroidery will look like, on a garment or as a patch. And, the person, my client can say, my pet's, eyes aren't that green, or, the whiskers need to be more scraggly. So I can make those adjustments before and then we can go back and forth. And if any sort of changes need to be made at that point, so that's all digital, then I go into the embroidery process after that. So
I see.
That's worked out really well for me because, you know, people have some agency to like make those changes. It's a lot easier to make a change on a digital drawing than it is a stitch. So that's worked out really well.
Right. Right. Okay. That's awesome. And are you selling these on, is it Etsy? Is it Shopify? Is it something else?
Yeah, I started with Etsy, just cause it's very easy to set up an Etsy shop. Then I just wanted to do Shopify. I was familiar with the Shopify platform. I liked the, you know, all the customizations that you can do. So, and also Etsy started their Star Seller program, which for me was not very great because, you know, I say the turnaround time for these embroideries is like, you know, I say 4 to 6 weeks. Often it doesn't take that long, but I just give myself that buffer. And so Etsy is not super into, doesn't seem to be super into like that sort of time frame. I just felt like the writing was kind of on the wall. I'm like, okay, this program is great for a lot of people, I'm sure, but it just doesn't work for me. So that was the kind of the push I needed for to go to Shopify. And, you know, having this background and blogging and things like that and just messing with how things look, I love messing with, you know, templates and stuff like that and customizing things. So I loved the customization of Shopify. And, you know, it's more expensive up front to do, you know, there's like a yearly fee, but I found that it's easy to make that back. And, you know, with Etsy, I just felt like I was getting so many different fees and stuff like that, that was frustrating to me.
Right. Okay. All right. So the second book, the new book, as we said, it's published with Schiffer, and it was many years in between, and you developed this new embroidery business during that time period. So how did the idea for this come about, and how did you connect with this publisher?
Yeah. So again, through my blog and Instagram, Brown Paper Bag Instagram, originally Marcia Young was with Schiffer, and I had connected with her years ago, and she was working for Schiffer at the time when she contacted me, and she was just like, oh, would you like to meet and just kind of talk about, you know, so has she had some like ideas or just kind of things she wanted to riff on? And so
was she the founder of Fiber Art now?
Yes. Yeah.
I believe she was the founder.
So yeah. I had talked to her, you know, at that time about Fiber Art Now, just kind of like how to build an Instagram presence or some ideas for content for that.
And I see.
So we had been familiar that way, or familiar like and talked on the phone and stuff. And so she was at Schiffer, and, you know, I just thought she kind of wanted to chat about, you know, current trends and things like that. So I went into the call just thinking it was going to be a conversation about, you know, what are people doing in embroidery now? And it turned out to be, you know, we were kind of talking through the like different ideas, and we're talking about treasure, things like that. And at the end, she was like, well, would you want to write a book about it? And I was like, sure, that would be kind of a dream project for me. And so then things started moving. We had another maybe meet couple calls where we kind of hammered out the exact sort of like how the outline of the book. And at that point, my editor, Sandra Kornacek, got involved and helped me sort of refine it more. And, you know, I wrote the, you know, the pitch and got that formally, you know, acquired from Schiffer. And yeah, started working on the book after that. So again, it was something I wasn't actively pitching or looking for. It just sort of fell into my lap by way of making these connections a long time ago.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it really speaks to the value of building relationships and building a network, mm-hmm. because so much of what I'm hearing from the opportunities that have come your way have come because of that. And generosity and highlighting other people's work and just being somebody who's consistently there doing what you're doing over a long period of time. So yeah, I think that's great. And one thing that really struck me about the new book is that the cover doesn't have a photo on it. Mm-hmm. So in Sarah's book, it's a picture of what you would expect, which is Sarah's embroidery on the cover. And I do wonder whether that is part of what led to some people's misperception. Okay, this is going to be a book of Sarah's patterns. Yeah, and then, oh, it's not that, you know. And I can understand why Sarah would want a cover with a picture of her embroidery because that's her work. At the same time, like had it, I think that the new book, it's kind of brilliant that the cover is, I don't know, I don't have a copy of it. So I don't know whether it's like cloth. It almost looks like denim. Like it's this blue sort of cover with writing on it, but it doesn't have, it's not like a big splashy photo of embroidery.
Yeah, so it's a blue cover with a gold foil. So all of the elements are like a foil. I'll send you a copy. it's this foil, and it's because the book is so it's kind of wide reaching. It's a lot of different artists who all have different styles. So for me, when I was working with the designer, I was just saying like I want something clean and sort of modern feeling, and they came back with these really great illustrations for the cover that are used kind of throughout the book, like these different illustrative elements. And I was thrilled with it because I feel like it kind of like a unifying force of all of these different artists and styles that are represented in the book.
Yeah. And I think as a reader, you're going to go into this expecting there to be stories because that looks like a storybook.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so I think that's smart. We'll see how people react. But to me that, obviously it's also not about one single person. So that's also quite different. So that's neat. And I want to make sure we talk about Camp Craftway because I feel like that's such a cool thing. It's also collaboration. I mean, I feel like you really do work together with other people a lot. And so this is one where you're also working together with somebody else. So tell us who that is and how you met and how you came up with this idea and what people can expect if they go to a summer camp for grownups who love crafting.
Yeah. So it's with Melissa Galbraith, who is another Craft Industry Alliance person.
She is. Yeah. And Creative J. Yep.
Yeah. And Creative J. Yes. Thank you. We both live in the Seattle area. And so I met her when I moved here when she was working at, I think Urban Craft Uprising in Seattle. And then we started like embroidering together and stuff like that. And we've gone to Craftcation together a couple of times. It'll be the third time next week is when we're going.
Yeah.
And we just both really love all the crafts and love getting together and making crafts. One of the first ways I really hung out with her was she invited me to embroidery like craft session. And so we really like that idea. We wanted to take that and kind of produce it on a larger scale. And so, yeah, Camp Craftway is on the shores, we call it on the shores of West Seattle. It's in this, it's called the Alki Beach Bathhouse. This year, we're going to have 19 different craft workshops so that are wide ranging. So the idea is that they're all beginner friendly. It's a way for you to try a bunch of different crafts. So I'll be teaching an embroidery workshop, but we're also going to have, like cyanotypes. I'm like blanking on what we're going to have. Cyanotypes, block printing, watercolors, all at a beginner level. So you get to try a bunch of things, even if you're not feeling comfortable with it. And then also build community. So being able to meet other crafters and get to know them over this shared love of making. That's the most, one of the most important parts of it for us. And it's a lot of fun. It's, it's a lot of making. So we start on Friday. We have keynote. So Tammy Bennett, who is also I met through Craft Industry Alliance.
I love Tammy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She was part of I'm on the mastermind or was in a craft industry mastermind. And so she was our expert and loved talking to her. And so she's going to be our keynote speaker. And then there's just all these different workshops you can try. So it will be a lot of fun and Yeah, it's just a lot of baking, but it's a really great way to connect with people, especially it's a lot of Pacific Northwest folks. So, you know, you can meet people and then maybe make connections outside of camp and, you know, spend time with people that way. We have a Discord server that we, you know, you can connect with people after the camp as well.
It sounds like my dream come true. I love it. And I'm sure lots of people listening are like, oh my God, it's exactly what I want to do with my, you know, vacation time. Yeah. So that sounds great. So congratulations to you. I hope it's a huge success and is something that, you know, only grows from here, because I think they're, you know, especially in that region, there's definitely a huge need for it. And it's just, I mean, anything that brings people together as community around craft is like amazing. So I love that. I want to make sure we get to your recommendations before we have to go. So you wanted to recommend a book, and is it called 4,000 Weeks Time Management for Mortals? That sounds great.
Yeah, that, you know, in Threads of Treasure, I kind of talk about ways. There's a section about, you know, working on daily projects. And so talking about like time and blocking out time and making time for yourself. And so this book was, I went into it thinking it was going to be a productivity book, like do these 10 things to like maximize your day. It was not that at all. It was really a philosophical look at time and how we kind of talk about time as this, we're divorced from time. Like if only I had more time, as if like more time can come to me. But really we are time ourselves. Like, and so how you spend it and how you spend your days is your time. And so it's like a shift. It had like a shift for me of like, you know, things are going to take as long as they take. You know, you can't really overschedule yourself. You should just kind of try to do the things that you love and think and know that the way that you spend your time is the way that you spend your life. So it was a really good reminder of that.
Yeah, I think especially as we get older, I'm like going to be turning 50 in a year, and I have a lot of feelings about time that have struck me recently. So that sounds like a good one. You also wanted to recommend an app called Figma.
Oh, yeah.
To tell us about Figma for visual planning.
Yeah, so Figma is kind of a whiteboard software. I think it was recently acquired by Adobe.
Acquired by Adobe, yes.
Yeah. So it kind of slots into this Creative Suite pretty well if you use that. But yeah, it's basically just this really flexible space. And there's all these sorts of things you can do. You can make mind maps. You can put sticky notes on things. You can collaborate really easily with others on it. That's how I first started using it, was as a collaboration tool. But now I use it as a visualization tool for planning. So I'm working on a set of patch kits. So wild animal patch kits that will launch in June. And so I have this like instruction book that I'm going to use for it. So I'm actually using Figma to sort of plan out the structure of the book. I have like sticky notes that I use, let's say like, oh, make sure I mention that in the book, and things like that. So I have it on my laptop and on my iPad. So it's really easy that when I have a thought, I can just kind of jot it down in Figma. And it's really good if you want to like rearrange it, like rearrange spreads or things like that. So I just find it really helpful as a very visual person to organize my thoughts.
And I think it's collaborative as well. Like I think that's one of the features that a lot of people like. Like if you have a team that's remote or whatever, that's working together on a visual project, it's something that everyone can kind of access.
Yeah. So the way I started using it was, I'm on the board of an illustration conference called ICON. And we use it. We used it initially as icebreakers because everybody is kind of spread out throughout the country. And so when the board first started meeting, we used it as icebreakers. So we used it for like two truths and a lie, where you would put these like, you know, your two truths and a lie, and then people would vote on what they thought was the lie. So it was very interactive in that way, which was really great. And then we're also, you know, we were planning on, you know, redesigning the book that you get with this conference. And so that we have done in Figma as well. You used it to like kind of use, basically ideate on what the book could do, what people have used it for in the past. And it was very collaborative. And so people could add what you know, their thoughts or make comments. And yeah, it's just a really great piece of software.
Yeah, I think that's awesome and is definitely appealing to listeners of this podcast. So that's great. And then the final recommendation you have good recommendations. The final one is Le Pen Pens.
Oh, yeah. I feel like I'm on a stationery journey this year. I bought a new planner and then I bought a notepad that I will scribble things down while I'm working. And I bought new journals because I had finished my one journal. And I just really wanted a nice set of pens to write with them. So I ordered a set of Le Pen pens and they just bring me so much joy. They're very colorful. They're very nice to write with. They're felt tip and I just really love them. And I was actually out last weekend and saw more colors I didn't have. So I picked up like 4 new pens and I'm really excited about it.
A new array of beautiful pens. Like what else could make you so happy? You know what I mean? It's like, that's like the best. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's real, sounds very silly, but I just really love, those pens. Like they just really, they make writing to-do lists more joyful.
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, Sarah, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on the Craft Industry Alliance podcast. It was great talking to you.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me.
And you've been listening to the Craft Industry Alliance podcast. I'm Abby Glassenberg. Today's episode was brought to you by the Show Up Society. If you're ready to overcome perfectionism and overthinking so you can grow your creative business, join the Show Up Society today. This supportive community helps you build confidence in your craft, in yourself, and in promoting your work. You'll get a perfect mix of practical tips and mindset hacks to grow your business without feeling salesy and without burnout. You'll have fun and feel supported while taking your creative business to new heights. Go to showupsociety.com/join today. Thank you so much to the Show Up Society. Craft Industry Alliance is a community for craft professionals. When you become a member of Craft Industry Alliance, you get in-depth coverage of craft industry news, the opportunity to connect with fellow professionals for advice and support, and access to an educational library filled with ideas, tools, and resources to help you as you build your business. Join us at craftindustryalliance.org. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.